What up, what up? I'm Michael Steele. This is the Man of Steel podcast. So glad you guys could be with us. We're coming to you live from Politicon here and out in LA. And this is my fourth Politicon. I've got my boys in the corner, right? We are joined today with a great conversation here with two guys that I have a great deal of respect for, and one of whom I've spent a lot of time working with over the years. Bill Kristol is the editor at large of the Weekly Standard, is a regular on ABC's This Week and on ABC's special events and election coverage, and appears frequently on other leading political commentary shows. I certainly get a chance to be with him from time to time over at MSNBC, which is always a real pleasure. Also, we are very happy to have with us his brother. Has been out there kind of rocking and rolling, kind of doing his thing here and there, right?
Just
a little bit. Shermichael Singleton is a Republican political consultant and contributing host of Vox Media's Consider It on at Facebook Watch, which is a new gig for you, right?
Yeah, new show.
Excellent. Well, I know Bill's on a tight schedule, so we want to get maximize our time with Bill. Bill Kristol, and just to kind of kick it off, so Politicon is all about political activists coming together. This is sort of the Comic-Con of politics, where really engaged folks come out, and particularly happening, 2 weeks before a general election, a very important general election, midterm election. What's your assessment of the political culture and climate right now in the country among activists, and how does that translate coming up in 2 weeks?
Good question. I don't know the answer. I mean, activism doesn't always correlate with electoral success. I mean, I was a kid in '64 and watching the Goldwater campaign, and I was 10 years old, 11 years old, but I knew people, older people who were young conservatives, extremely excited about Goldwater, and he lost, 60-40. So you do need to get independent voters. You need to get people who aren't activists. A key for any successful political party is mobilizing the activists and winning the independents at the same time, and I think that's the challenge for Democrats in 2 weeks. They need to get swing voters, they need to get young voters to turn out. I think the single biggest differential, and if you look at the polls, I'm sure you've done this, Michael, too, it's amazing how different the poll results are if you assume the universe of voters is the traditional universe, which means young people not voting much, a beginning to be proportionate number of young percentage of young voters actually voting. Somewhat true of minority voters too. So the Democrats have a huge interest in expanding the electorate and getting more young people to vote.
Well, and that's a very good jump on point, because right now what we're seeing, and I like the way you put it, I think it's important for people to understand that traditional polling view of the electorate versus the potential polling experience, meaning those folks who may turn out. We saw that in 2016, that undercounted, unrepresented vote that suddenly showed up. The expectation is, under the traditional model, that younger voters are still somewhat apathetic, despite all of the marching and the bravado. That at the end of the day, as was recently showed on our air on MSNBC, when the question was asked to 15 or 20 Gen Xers if they were going to vote, they were kind of like, voting? What's voting? Mm-hmm. So how does that play in for parties in terms of get that turnout model where you have this part of the electorate that's so irrational when it comes to voting? They don't take it from a rational perspective.
So to be fair to them, I mean, think about it. This is an off-year election. You're voting for senators or congressmen or women. Often if you're a younger voter, certainly if you're a student, but maybe if you're a young 24-year-old, 27-year-old, you just moved to the area you moved to. You're going to move from it in a year. You're in, graduate school, medical school, and you're just temporarily living nearby the school. You don't have the same attachment to your local area as a typical, middle-aged person with kids who's, lived there for 10 or 15 years. Your kids are in the schools and so forth. So it makes sense in a way that when you get away from a presidential election, which is a national election, to, California 49, if you're a 25-year-old who happens to be renting an apartment because it's convenient to your job in California 49, you don't really think necessarily, I have a huge interest in who our representative is. But given that it is important for the country, what happens this November, it's a challenge for Democrats, for liberal activists to mobilize those young voters, get them out. But it is important, obviously, in terms of the Trump administration I mean, it will be a huge victory for Trump if they increase the seats in the Senate and hold the House. I think it's unlikely, but I don't think it's impossible. And even in the Senate races, there are a lot of them in play. So it will be a big, interesting question whether you can get voters to see it's as important to vote right. in the midterm as in the presidential.
Well, Sir Michael, you're a young voter.
Yeah, true.
Well, I mean, what's your assessment in this particular space when you look at your generation and the generation behind you, the Gen Xers, mm-hmm. who are that 18 to 20, 25-year-old group? What's your expectation in terms of their participation?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest issue has been, I mean, beyond voter apathy, what's the reason for those voters, younger voters, to turn out? If you're in the middle of college, you're in the middle of trying to find a job, you're in the middle of trying to pay off student loans, et cetera, you're trying to figure out what the next step is going to be. You're not necessarily focused on elections as your right. parents might be or your grandparents, who are pretty much solidified and sort of set wherever they reside, that these are the individuals who will impact our life for the next 20 years, taxes, roads, etc. But I do think now, with Me Too, for example, I think you will see an increase in younger women right. being mobilized right. and participating in the voting process. I also think the same for African Americans with Black Lives Matter. I think that there is an increase in attention on those issues and discrepancies as far as race. So I do think, unlike what we've seen at least in the past maybe 20 years, we will probably see an increase in voter participation with younger voters.
And a lot at the core of all of this, folks, is the president. And he has, in recent weeks, which I find really unprecedented when you stop, Bill, and think about prior presidents in a midterm cycle, they generally kind of sit on the sidelines and go, oh, I'm not in this election. This isn't my election. This president is doubling down and saying, I'm on the ballot. When you go to the polls, I want you to vote for, quote, me. How does that play out? How does that animate both sides, in your estimation?
You know, obviously it hurts and it helps. And I think the conventional wisdom, which I kind of agree with, is it hurts in swing congressional districts where Trump is unpopular, where I live in Northern Virginia, kind of a classic swing district with a Republican congresswoman, a pretty good one, actually, who I think will lose probably because Trump is so unpopular in this district. But at the Senate level, what Trump's most, so he thinks he's going to lose the House. He'll have the excuse that usually you have a pretty bad result in the House. Right. If you control the presidency and both houses of Congress, there's usually a reaction in the first off-year election, like 94, like 2010. What he wants to do is pick up a Senate seat or two, which is possible because so many red states are in play with Democratic senators, mobilize his voters in Missouri, in North Dakota, in Indiana, and so forth, pick up a couple of states, minimize the losses, and then say, okay, it was a split verdict, pretty good verdict for me, actually. I can see Trump's, we shouldn't discount the ability of Trump to spin this as an adequate election for him. Now, I do think at the governor's level and the state legislature's level, it'll be a pretty bad night for Republicans. The Senate's important for Trump because it's the one place he could actually pick up a seat or two and use that to justify that it's been a referendum on him and he's done well. And incidentally, as a practical matter, having 52 or 53 Republican senators will change the vote on. We've had a lot of close votes in the Senate that are 50-50, 51-49, right? So it's not a trivial matter what happens there. I do think, just I'll say a word because I'm going to have to run off to this other panel. I mean, there are two analyses, really, of where we are right now 2 weeks out. One, Republicans have had something of a comeback the last couple of weeks. Trump's numbers have ticked up in approval. He's mobilizing red state voters, and the Democratic wave is not as big as some Democrats had hoped, A. Or B, sort of the opposite, which I'm slightly inclined to, which is you often get, let's call it a bear market rally in these, you remember these wave years. I remember 94 so well. The Democrats had kind of a rally in early October. Clinton was stumping out there. They got a couple of pieces of good news. The economy was picking up. And it was like, we're going to stop this Republican wave, and our incumbents are going to hold on, some of them. And then at the last 2 weeks, the wave kind of picks up steam again and crashes in a big way. I think that could happen this year. We could have had kind of a fake rally by Republicans.
That's a good point.
But we won't know for another 2 weeks. And there's a lot of fluidity. It's Trump's America. There's a 30-point gender gap. We've never really, I think, Michael, you're absolutely right, we haven't really tested a president out there stumping the way he is with these huge rallies. I mean, does that mobilize his voters? Does it turn off swing voters? So I think come back in 2.5 weeks.
Who knows? See where we are. But that, I think that's particularly interesting given when you're looking at the polling and you pull back some of the numbers, folks, you're seeing, and this has always been an important linchpin for Republicans, is that independent voters in the final analysis always move towards the right. That's not what the polling is starting to show, that independent voters are breaking more towards the left. And the question then becomes, how does that play, Shermichael, for Republicans to Bill's point, keep real what the president calls a red wave, if you will, by pulling back those independent voters who may be leaning more towards the left?
I mean, I think it matters most in the competitive districts where you sort of need that edge,
right,
in order to get candidates elected to office. I mean, after the Kavanaugh hearings, we saw initially there was a significant drop off in support for Republican candidates by and large, women and men,
right,
independent voters. But what you saw afterwards was that independent men began to swing back over to support Republicans. So I think that's a very interesting dynamic that I would like to see come 2 weeks, how that impacts,
right,
some of those Republicans running in tight districts. But overall, I think the president has to be very, very careful because there are Republicans who are running in districts that are red, but not hard red. And if there is an increase in turnout with Democrats, they are going to need and rely on those independent voters to push them over.
Well, you know, I think we're at the point in this election where we ask that age-old question, what will white women do? Because that, at the end of the day, is really going to be the outcome determined part. And the interesting little bubble to that little nugget is, what will black women do? The black female vote has become an important piece, mm-hmm, in the electoral process, unlike any that we've seen in recent history. We go back to Alabama and the Roy Moore case, where you had African-American women turn out at a rate higher, folks, than they did for Barack Obama in 2008. And as I remember saying to the party chairman at that time, I said, you got a problem. If black women are willing to come out and vote against a Republican at a higher rate than they are willing to come out and vote for the first black president, you got a problem. And I think that's an aspect of this campaign. One of those intangible, one of those unknowns, with a black female running for governor in Georgia, a black male running for governor of Florida, on the Democratic side, but even on the Republican side, we have an African-American running, mm-hmm, for the United States Senate in Michigan and in Maryland. That vote becomes a very dynamic and interesting one that I don't think is captured that much in pollings, the way you and I kind of look at them,
yeah,
from our own experience.
I mean, the pollsters, it's, you know, who you talk to just really don't know who's going to vote. And but you have such, think about it this way, just as a sort of political science matter. If every group votes 60-40, Democrat or Republican, let's just say, it doesn't really matter which groups turn out more, right? Even if one group turns out twice as much as another, if they're both 60-40,
right,
the ultimate result 60-40.
Right.
If, as is now the case, you have huge gaps, obviously on race, also on ethnicity, also on gender, also on education, the who votes really becomes important. And if you get African-American women turning out 50% more than traditionally has been the case in a state like Missouri,
yeah,
or even a red state, or Indiana, which are both red states but have high African-American populations, it really changes the result. And they vote 95-5. It can really move 3-4 points in a general in the election, which is all you need to put someone over. So I very much agree. The whole turnout, it's almost a cliche. It all depends on turnout. But it really depends on turnout when groups are more different from each other than is normally the case. And this is the most striking thing. I was once taught political science a little bit, and I'll close on this. I got to go do this panel. But
yep,
we have never seen groups as different from each other, I don't believe, as we have in this election, by gender, by education, by region. And so which of them votes in states that have a lot of different, you know, states typically, congressional districts are more uniform. So where I live in Northern Virginia, white women, I believe, are going to swing hugely against Trump, and that's going to be that. But if you're in Missouri or Indiana or Florida, to take three competitive Senate races, governor's races in states like Florida or Ohio or Georgia, there are a lot of people in states, you know, a lot of diverse people, a lot of diverse groups. And so the rate at which they turn out and then how they vote really matters. So it is, to get back to your original point in terms of the theme of this conference, I mean, sometimes your vote doesn't matter, but this year more than most, I think it probably does matter, and people should vote and get their friends, neighbors, acquaintances, and everyone else they know to vote as well.
I appreciate it. Bill Kristol, everybody.
Thank you, Michael.
Bill's got to run to another panel, but I really appreciate you coming in, stopping in, and spending a little bit of time with the fellas over here at Man of Steel. So I have a friend that I see sitting in the audience, and I'm gonna call her out and see if she wants to come in. You know her from CNN. Tara Settmeyer, you want to come on up and take a hot seat, hang out with the fellas? Now, you know, the idea, we want to have a conversation. I can't think of Tara did the podcast a while back, and I think it'll be good to have her up here to sort of kind of create the equilibrium here on the panel. Tara Settmeyer, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. This is totally impromptu.
It is. I just looked up and saw her sitting there. I was going, let me see if she's not doing anything next. Let me get her up here. All right. So let's kind of break it down a little bit more. We talked the politics, but there are a lot of things that impacts politics, folks. It's not just the idea of voting. It's not just the idea of going out, putting up signs. It's all the stuff that sort of leads into that. And a lot of that is both domestic news as well as international news. And the big international news story right now that I know you're covering over at CNN, we're covering at MSNBC, yeah. And then you're in a couple of other spots,
all
too.
All over the
you're
place.
You're all over the place. These brothers are working hard. Is Jamal Khashoggi. And the storyline, the narrative that is coming out of Saudi Arabia, where now they finally admit, well, yeah, maybe he got killed in a fight with 15 guys who were
carrying
twice his age, and right
to a fist fight.
How does this narrative play into this election, or is it something that sort of skips over the election process and will get played out going into the second term, Tara?
Well, the issue with the Khashoggi murder that makes it so troubling is the administration's response to it, and the fact that you have a president of the United States who repeatedly calls the press the enemy of the people. Words have consequences. I've been in political communications for 25 years, and I've never been more serious about words matter. And when you have, you know, the world looks to the United States as the shining city on a hill. We're supposed to be the moral authority. You know, the United States is always known to do the right thing. When you have a president of the United States who continues to not do the right thing, who seems to almost be nihilist in the way that he approaches foreign policy, where human rights used to matter to the U.S., the issue of Jamal Khashoggi's murder becomes more of a microcosm for larger problems with what a Trump presidency is creating for us in the global sphere. You know, this whole thing about, well, we're owning the libs, we're winning. Are we on a global stage? I mean, I had my issues with Barack Obama's foreign policy and some of the weakness that America showed under Obama. But this strength by any means necessary, even if that means undermining the basic tenets and institutions of our country, that's not okay either. So that's where the Khashoggi murder, I think, takes on a larger role than normally, because most Americans don't know who that is. They don't, you know, they outside the Beltway, they're like, well, some Saudi guys, they you know, killed somebody in Turkey. Like, people don't really know what that's about. And I get it, it doesn't affect you on an everyday basis. But it's a larger metaphor for what's going on and why we have to continue to hold Trump accountable and the people who make excuses for him accountable, because it's a larger problem moving forward. It's life after Trump. Where does that put the United States on the moral, moral scale here? And that, to me, has always been a problem. Also, not to mention the financial, the financial conflicts of interest that the president has with the Saudis, which also contributes to why he's so reluctant to ever criticize the Saudis or the Russians. Because
I took note of the president's tweet. Tara and Sir Michael, when he tweeted out,
have no financial interest in Saudi Arabia.
Right. Yeah. In Saudi Arabia.
He said the same thing about Russia.
As opposed to with Saudi Arabia.
Words matter.
And words matter. And I kind of chuckled, because the truth for the folks at Trump Tower Plaza is the financial stream that was once funded by the Russians is no longer such. And it's not Michael Steele saying that or any of us saying it. It's his own son said that. Yeah. That was their biggest, they were their largest financiers. But given the scrutiny now with the Russian probe and all of that, there has been, and there's a reason why there's been a play up between Donald Trump Jr. and the Saudis, and certainly with Jared Kushner and the Saudis, because there's a property on Fifth Avenue that's in financial distress. There are other assets that are problematic. How does that narrative color the already fraught relationship with the Saudi government, particularly given, 17 or so of the 19 or so, 21, 15. 15
of the 19 were Saudis.
Of the 19 were Saudis.
Including UBL himself.
That flew planes into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. We've had this kind of weird relationship with the Saudi government. We know the Bush family relationship. How does all of this now play out for us? Now that you have staring us in the face, the death of a man that we all saw walk into a building and not come out.
I mean, I don't think it plays out very well. And I really do believe, to Tara's point, it does undermine our ability to sort of be the moral leader of the world, particularly when you think about the president, who in 2015, which he lied in that tweet, he said at a rally that the Saudis paid $45 million, I believe, to buy an entire floor at Trump Tower. He also talked about other financial dealings with the Saudis and how they're rich and how it's great to do business with them. So I think this is why you have to see his taxes. And I'm almost of the point to say maybe any person who runs for office should go through the same background check as intelligence officers before they can even run, so that we're aware of what financial dealings they have with people around the world.
Yeah.
Because the implications for this, when you think about China, for example, China's in South America. China is spreading throughout parts of Africa. They're in the Middle East now.
So
you think about their movement strategically and long-term and how they're slowly positioning themselves to become the world's leading power. You're wondering, what in the heck is the United States doing? What is our foreign policy strategy moving forward under the Trump presidency? And to be quite frank, there isn't one. It seems to be non-existent if it's not in Trump's
It's America first, Michael. On board.
Maybe Trump first.
That's right.
If it's
That's
for
exactly
his financial
right.
gain.
That's well, exactly
but,
right.
But can, all that notwithstanding, he's winning. He's winning. The fact of the matter is that regardless of the relationship with the Saudis, the Chinese, the Russians, it doesn't matter. Regardless of the statements about and towards women, the most recent referring to a female as a horse face, doesn't matter. If the man's on the ballot this November or on the ballot in 2020, he gets reelected. So what does it say about us that is the reality, that is the truth? He's not the problem as much as he is a reflection of a broader symptom of issues that we have inside our own culture, our own psyche as Americans, that we are not dealing with, that we're acting vicariously through this president, I think, in so many ways. If that were not the case, then there would not be the kind of space that you saw for Charlottesville to take place. There would not be the kind of space where you saw what happened in the Kavanaugh hearings, that there would be a greater sensitivity in those areas, because the American people will have made it very clear, this is the line that we've drawn. But that line was not drawn when they looked at the Access Hollywood tape and said, okay, yeah, president, next one, good, keep going.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this from the very beginning that, it's I call it the Jerry Springerization of our politics. Once we started, actually goes back even further. It started for me, at least I think, when Bill Clinton was asked boxers or briefs during an MTV Rock the Vote town hall. Remember that?
Yeah.
Sure, Michael was like two, so he probably doesn't
remember. No, diaper.
Right, yeah. Were you born in 92? Anyway.
No.
1992, years before.
I bust him all the time about it. But that's really where it started. I mean, could you imagine if someone had asked, Eisenhower that? Or even Ronald Reagan something like that? People thought it was being hip because Bill Clinton was younger, he played saxophone, he hung out with black folks and ate at the church picnics and stuff, and they were like, oh, he's cool. That's fine, but this is still the office of the presidency of the most powerful country in the world, the greatest democracy to ever live, and you're asking the president about what kind of drawers he wears? I was horrified by that, and so ever since then, it's kind of opened up the presidency to more and more indignities. And then obviously we know what Bill Clinton did in the White House with an intern, which was also quite a low moment for me, at least for the presidency. But Bill Clinton left office with over 60% approval. Why? Because I think the average person does not want to hold leaders accountable for the fallibilities in their own lives. Because then if you pass judgment, you actually have to kind of look at yourself and go, oh, well, who am I? And people don't want to do that. It's difficult to be self-reflective. So I think that Donald Trump has become the grievance monger in chief, because all these people that have all these grievances, they feel so aggrieved. They're victims of immigrants. They're victims of, you know, trade. They're victims. They feel victimized, whether it's legitimate or not. They feel that way. And Trump zeroed in on that. And instead of appealing to our better angels, as we hear a lot of people say, he appealed to the lowest common denominator and fear. And this is what we see now manifested. So we are responsible for the government we get. I at this point, I'm not even mad at Donald Trump anymore. He's been a despicable person forever, and he told us that. He showed us and said, I don't care. And people were like, we don't care either, as long as you win for us. And I think that that is not a sustainable way forward for a republic and for people to govern that way. You just can't govern like that, because we have moral foundations and things in our Constitution that are supposed to protect checks and balances, that it's not just about winning and owning the libs. It's bigger than that.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with everything you said, Tara. Personally, though, I think the election of Trump, the candidacy of Trump, revealed everything that already existed in this country. And I think for a long time, I always like to use this analogy. You know, when you're a kid and you're cleaning up and you have to sweep or something, I used to do this when I was a kid. My mom said, oh, sweep up the dust. I'd lift up the rug and sweep it under there and put it down and say, I'm done, Mom. And I think many of the problems in our country, we sort of lifted the rug and we swept them. We didn't have to look at it anymore. And then over time, you forget, oh, we forget this even exists. And I think Trump came along and said, you know what? I'm just going to lift it all up. And then it spreads all over the place, and people are wondering, well, how did this happen? I thought we were better than this. No, we never really addressed any of the issues that have been lingering for this entire time. And so I hope, maybe I'm wrong, but I hope as we go through this moment in time, we finally address issues of race. We finally address issues of sex. We finally address issues of economic disparity and urban disparity. That's my hope. But I think Trump only came along and just lifted what was already there that we as a country continue to sort of bypass, because we don't ever want to actually tackle it head on.
Because it's hard to be self-reflective.
Yeah,
it is.
I got a slightly better analogy for you. So what you used, as a kid, you used to take the dust and sweep it
under the rug.
I got one better. So I never liked my vegetables. And my mama was like, you got to eat your vegetables. And I'm like, okay. So she would, you know, I'd linger at the dinner table. And then when she would leave the kitchen, I'd take a napkin, paper towel, and I'd wrap what I didn't want to eat in the paper towel and throw it behind the refrigerator. So you can imagine, folks, that over a period of time, when you're throwing food behind the refrigerator, two things happen. One, you begin to smell stuff that you're like, what is that and where is it coming from? And two, little critters start to appear in the house that were not there before. And to your point, my mother isolated where it was coming from and then pulled back the refrigerator, and there it is. And I think to both your points, that's kind of what we've done as a country. We've just kind of wrapped stuff up that we don't want to deal with it. We toss it aside and we leave it there, not realizing that over time that will become rot. And at some point, you're going to have to deal with that. And there are a whole lot of creatures that will come in and feed off of that.
Yes.
That you don't necessarily want in your house.
Right.
And I think that's kind of the reality that both parties, quite honestly, are facing. While there's a lot of focus on Donald Trump and the Republican parties, and rightly so, because we are the governing majority at this point. On the Democratic side, you find the same thing. You find that same tension that exists there. You see it reflected in just the recent action where activists, the Bernie Sanders activists within the party, changed the rules within the Democratic Party. You have a great deal of concern about, you know, what Elizabeth Warren candidacy for the presidency means for the Democratic Party. There's not this, you know, forward embrace, yes, we're going to go with Elizabeth. There are these tensions that exist there because, like we see on the right, there's still issues that they're not dealing with because they're issues that affect all of us, you know, in our politics in some way.
But I think the difference for the Democrats is that it's more about ideology, you know, whether it's the Democratic Socialist approach versus progressives versus the more, you know, blue dog Democrats, if they still exist. I think it's more like that. For us, I think it is a moral battle. We are like some of the things that, and some of what Republicans and conservatives have accepted in order to embrace Trump has turned them into hypocrites. So it's that I think is the difference. I don't think with Democrats are really fighting about what, you know, all of a sudden like apostasies in policy differences. They're just, it's, you know, ideological differences in how they approach policy. For Republicans, it's the heart and soul of what it meant to be a Republican and a conservative that's just been completely turned on its head and perverted. That is a deeper conflict, I think, going on for us because of just the, for someone like myself who's worked in politics, Republican politics in the front lines for 20 plus years, to actually sit here and say, I think the Democrats need to win the House in November in order for a course correction to happen to rein Trump in. It almost like I want to gag on those words. Right. I've never rooted for Republicans to lose anything more in my life. But I feel like the course, the only way you ever change and pay a price is if you, it creates enough pain. You have to pay a price if you're going to change. And I just don't think that the party, the way it exists today, is representative of what Republican principles and conservative principles really were. It's representative of a cult of personality. And I just don't know how that's sustainable in a republic where you need a healthy two-party system.
Well, I think part of that sort of cult of personality revealed itself. And I think it, again, goes to the symptoms that you were talking about, Shermichael, when just this week on Thursday, the president was in Montana stomping for Congressman Greg.
You say stomping?
I know, right?
Yeah. Stomping body.
Yeah,
stomping.
Yeah.
That was a Freudian
I went there. It was kind of Freudian, actually. Yeah. Well, and that was the point. He was there for Congressman Greg Gianforte, who, as you all recall, was the congressman who was caught on tape body slamming a Guardian reporter back in 2017, Ben Jacobs. And the president said, quote, in talking about Greg, he said, Greg's smart and, by the way, never wrestle with him. And any guy who can do a body slam, he's my kind of guy. The crowd cheers and roars at that. Now, that actually by itself is can be kind of a funny one-off comment that any candidate could make. In any other kind of setting.
Right.
How is that now materially different in this environment with the president saying that versus if, you know, a George Bush had said something similar during a campaign encounter or, you know, the way, you know, the way George Bush made fun of the reporter who threw a shoe at him when he was in the Middle East. How is that different from what Trump is saying now in this public space where you can look back and go, hey, that's actually kind of funny. And it's, you know, he's making sort of a funny jest about what this congressman did.
I mean, I think it's so different now because Trump at every corner attacks the media. There, at every corner, he attempts to legitimize every single thing the media does. They're the only institution that's protected by the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about totalitarian states, the first thing you do is attack the media. You destroy the media. You decrease trust in the media. Why? Because then there's no one to hold you accountable. Then you don't have to be transparent.
Yep.
And to bring this back to Jamal Khashoggi, this is why, from my perspective, Trump doesn't really have any legitimacy to even talk about this issue because of what he's done to the press in our own country. And so I think as a conservative, it concerns me because you think about conservatism, wanting to conserve something. You think about customs of behavior and norms. And all of those things are important to upholding our institutions that allow this thing to work, even dysfunctionally at times. You have a Republican president who purports to maintain those values, delegitimizing all of those values every single chance, every opportunity he gets. So from my perspective, I think it's very, very different when Trump says it, because he has taken away any legitimacy that a president typically would have as it relates to transparency, as it relates to freedom of speech, as it relates to the media doing their job and actually covering him, which is hard. They're going to write negative things about you. Sometimes they're going to report things that's not always fair, but you know this when you take the job. But the issue with Trump, however, he is an individual who is an egoist. It's all about Trump. He doesn't like criticism. And like a totalitarian state, when you don't like people who criticize you, what do? You crush them. And that's what he's essentially doing to the press.
So, but he may be doing that with the press, but he's getting help and support from his own party, wouldn't you say? I mean, where does a party, and not just specifically the Republican Party, but where does a party draw the line, or should it draw the line?
We should have drawn the line when he was a candidate. And they had and you know this better than everybody as a former RNC chairman. There were rules in place, and I remember I was on a presidential campaign for a Republican. They had rules in place where they could have prohibited Trump from becoming the nominee of the party. They didn't. They said, well, this is what the voters want. They knew all the risk if this guy were to become president, and they ignored all of those things.
They underestimated it, though, Sure, Michael.
Well, I don't think so,
Tara. Yeah, they underestimated it. And by the time they realized that, holy shit, this guy could actually win, it was too late.
They could have changed the rules at convention.
They could have.
They had every opportunity to.
But then you had Mitch
McConnell.
That's
why he hired Paul Manafort.
Yes, among other reasons. Right. Paul Manafort had... they needed to pay back Russians when he offered to give them free VIP briefings on what was going on with the campaign. But anyway, but Paul Manafort, I mean, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and some of the leaders in the party saw, well, if we get this guy in, then we can get that tax cut we always wanted. We can get judges.
Well, they thought they could manage him.
But they could get that with any other Republican candidate.
Underestimated that. You know, bless Paul Ryan's heart, but he's from Wisconsin. Okay? They are very nice people in Wisconsin. Wisconsin ain't Manhattan. You know, I'm from Jersey. Trust me, I grew up with Donald Trump and, you know, New York real estate on the front page of the New York Post and how he devastated Atlantic City and ran the casino businesses into the ground there. I know how ruthless Donald Trump was, and I tried to warn people, but they didn't listen. They didn't listen to me. Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and those guys, they were so ill-prepared for what Donald Trump was bringing them, and that miscalculation is what's gotten us to that point. That's why they didn't invoke those rules.
But they
could have. Ted Cruz thought he was going to be able to do it.
Any one of those Republican candidates could have garnered tax cuts, deregulation.
That's correct.
Strengthening the military.
Immigration
more hard
reform,
power versus soft power as it relates to foreign
healthcare.
Relations. I mean, Trump didn't bring anything that any of those other 15 guys, 16 guys, and I think one woman, could have potentially did if they were able to win the presidency.
Without undermining institutions.
So that's why him. I think the party has been derelict in their duty 100%. Of preserving the republic. Some things are bigger than party. You can only win for so long. Presidents come to go. This guy's only going to be here at most 2 more years. If he's lucky, maybe 6 if he wins re-election. But then what happens after that?
Yep.
What happens to how we debate one another? What happens to dialogue, to civility? All of those things that we once maintained as being important, as being an American, have essentially...
But were we being honest about all of that as Americans?
That's another question.
I mean, over the last 25, 30 years, have we been honest about that dialogue and that civility as we slowly metastasized into red states versus blue states? And we go back to the way Congressman Newt Gingrich sort of came onto the political landscape and sort of reoriented the way the House operated, the way the rules were played in the House. And that was kind of became a foundation in many respects.
That was the beginning of tribalism, I would argue.
The beginning of the tribalism that we now see manifest today. So this idea that we've always, you know, we look ideally back on the past and talk about how we were then.
Right.
Yeah, well, I was there then. And
me too.
It wasn't necessarily as neat and clean. And that's why
But it happened more behind the scenes.
It happened more behind
the scenes.
You
didn't have it as illuminated as you do now with social media, 24-hour news cycles, and we're inundated with it, so it's exposed more than it was before.
It is, and so the fact that it is exposed more now is, I think, one of the interesting dynamics, again, bringing Trump back into the conversation that way, where he's able to pick that scab and sit back and watch the bleeding.
Yeah.
And as opposed to a lot of these prior Republican leaders put the Band-Aid on the wound and walked away from it. And so the question then becomes for the party, which is worse? I mean, that's the question you're asking on a longer term.
Right.
When this is over, are we just going to put a Band-Aid now back on this wound and just kind of walk away from it? Or are we actually going to try to heal what I think has been a 35-year struggle inside the party? Once Reagan stepped off the political stage, the party then gravitated towards one question: who's the next Reagan?
Yeah.
And they've been in search of that individual ever since. My argument is, well, he's a once-in-a-generation, lifetime kind of political figure. That's like asking, well, who's the next Abraham Lincoln?
Mm-hmm.
That just doesn't come like that. So the question is, how do then we, until such time as that person emerges or whatever, however that develops, how do we then function as a community? And I think what Trump is like, we'll just have some fun.
Yeah,
we'll
who cares?
We'll have some fun between. We saw Republicans sit on the couch in the Oval Office helplessly as he had his powwow with Nancy and Chuck and started cutting deals on immigration right there with Nancy and Chuck that were counter to everything those other individuals were sitting there
about. I was in your other panel when you were making that point. You got booed by the Charlie Kirk crew that was over there.
Yeah.
And I just thought to myself, wait till all you MAGA hat wearing folks who think you're winning and owning the libs, wait till Donald Trump starts cutting those deals with Nancy Pelosi and
Thank
Chuck
you.
Schumer.
Yeah.
Then what? What are you going to say then? Now all of a sudden we're like, yeah, we're all about those Democrat policies because we're winning.
And
what?
And to that point, Tara, we're already seeing it on healthcare.
Of course.
How many Republican candidates in the last 3 weeks all of a sudden now are defending the pre-existing condition?
Yep.
Wait a minute. You supported and voted for a bill that got rid of the pre-existing condition.
Over 30 times in the House, by the way.
And now you're sitting here saying, oh, we're for the pre-existing condition, which again, I get back to the question of us.
Yeah.
How do we look at this as citizens, and how do we bake all of this in this democratic pie that we, and that's, you know, small d democratic, this democratic pie that we bake every single day in this country that we have to be mindful of, that it doesn't come out undercooked or it doesn't come out overcooked and burned. How do we bake all of that in as citizens? And I think that's potentially what this election could be about.
Of course it's going to be a referendum on Trump and Republicans, but...
Or Trumpism.
Trumpism. But I really think once Trump is gone, what's going to happen to those 30-35% of the country that supports him? Those people aren't going to just disappear. And I haven't seen anything from the party as far as leadership to sort of address some of their grievances, whether legitimate or not. The country's going to continue to become more diverse. What do we do? Those people, for whatever reason, that's not realistic. But those people, they have fears about economics. They have fears about being marginalized because of the changing racial landscape of the country. No one's addressing that.
But you still have people screaming, build the wall.
Right. Even though 40% of illegal immigrants are visa overstays that don't come from the southern border. You know, but I think the answer to your question, Michael, is that we need a better informed citizenry. People are more engaged now than they ever.
They got the internet.
I know, that's right. Just Google it.
They got Google. What do you mean you need a better informed citizenry,
look at what you can find on Google, you know? I mean, there's information now.
Google Russia.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Google Russia. I just think that a lot of folks, like in our school systems, we're not teaching kids basic civics. We're not teaching people what the founding fathers intended when they put the Constitution together, how our government is supposed to be functioning as a constitutional republic. These are things that sometimes people's eyes glaze over because they're like, oh, we don't care about that. But that's what's at stake here. Those guardrails that were put in place that have allowed this democracy to flourish for so long are being challenged. And if we have more and more people that are willing to accept these outside the norm behaviors that the president's engaging in, then we have a problem, because it's chipping away at democratic norms, institutions, and ideals. And that's how you fall into tyranny. And I worry about that. What did Ronald Reagan say? Freedom is only one generation away from losing it. And I see that happening. So we have to continue to, in people like us that are in positions to inform, people like you that are engaged, you have to inform yourself with facts,
Tara,
of what's going on,
inform,
and stand up for it.
But how do you inform people? And I have a lot of friends that are Trump supporters, as we all do.
You know, they don't want to listen
but,
to
but
it.
But how do you inform people who don't accept facts?
Yeah.
Who don't accept
those people,
precedent? Who,
those,
I mean, how do you
we're
inform
have to write
those
them,
people?
I mean, frankly, I think you have to write them off.
30% of the country?
I mean, you figure out a way around it. You're just going to have to accept that those people are not going
to
move.
So then
and
what
that's
happens
unfortunate.
To the Republican
I don't know,
Party
I don't know
then.
How we change
that. So the rest
that.
Of America moves on.
Right.
You have the Republican Party, and most of these individuals vote Republican. That's a question that I think we as conservatives have to figure
yeah,
out
I don't know
how
what the
to
answer
address
is.
What's right. going on within our party. Yeah. This isn't an issue on the left. This is an issue on our side.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what
right.
we do.
Right.
I don't know what we do with those folks, because you can't have a rational argument with people who are irrational. And that these folks have gotten to the point where they're like irrational. I tried for a long time not to criticize Trump supporters, but it's gotten way beyond that. After Charlottesville, that's out. It's over with now. Because when you start justifying there are fine people on both sides, I don't have time for it. That means that you are willing to accept just about anything.
But it speaks to, I think
to defend him.
Well, yeah, and I think it speaks to all of this, speaks to a real truth about the party. And it, again, goes back to something that I sort of talked to party leaders about at the time. And this is probably 2010, 11, in that time frame.
Tea Party time.
And that's the question of how do we deal internally with that struggle between conservatism versus republicanism. And what we've seen happen is this blended marriage of the two, where they really are two very different, separate principles.
They are.
Because you can be a Republican and not be a conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be a conservative and not necessarily be a Republican.
Yeah.
And so what we saw, really kind of going back to the Reagan era, where he was able to articulate this marriage in a way that everybody seemed comfortable with,
mm-hmm.
where he brought into the party for the first time this new emerging group called the Moral Majority.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had the introduction of faith into politics in a direct way. And so that became part of the link in the foundation. So you have all of these things that kind of built up over the years. He steps off the stage, and then these cracks begin to form, and this identity crisis begins to emerge within the party, where you now have these folks who are not identifying, to be honest, as conservative or Republican,
no.
but as Trumps, as
yep.
Trumpers. And so when I hear people say, well, Trump is the Republican Party, or the Republican Party is Trump, my problem is that this is not a true statement,
right.
because the Republican Party still exists in some form, weakened,
mm-hmm.
albeit,
yeah.
but still in some form. But Trumpism has risen in its stead and is rising in its stead. So I guess that leaves us with the question, as we kind of wind this down, is the Republican Party now prepared to go the way of the Whigs?
I say that all the time.
And
as
we are familiar that the Republican Party was born out of the Whigs. When the Whigs, which were the party that existed at the time that was not ready to make the move against slavery. As abolitionists
yeah.
were, and those individuals that were part of the Whig Party who were pro-abolitionist stepped outside the party, moved outside that party, and created what we now know as the Republican Party. Are we now seeing that transformation happen real time with the Republican Party as it moves outside and away from those profound values that they were formed on to follow these individuals are following this new political philosophy known as Trumpism?
Well, I think to Schermichael's point, we will go the way of the Whigs if the party can't figure out a way to be more inclusive. And that's what after
well,
the
country is changing.
Right, the country,
yeah.
you're not gonna stop that. And the Republicans recognized this after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, and they came out with the autopsy.
Yeah,
that was under your tenure, wasn't it?
No.
Oh, no, that was
I would never name. Right. I would never name anything an autopsy.
That's right. No, you came in after that.
I was before that.
Before that,
they
yeah.
came after
oh,
me.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I got all the wins that
that's
they're
right.
now about
that's
to
right.
lose.
That's right.
Right.
That's
so,
true.
Yeah. So the that's right. That was the Ryan's Priebus.
Yeah, that was Priebus.
That's right. That was Priebus.
That wasn't me.
I didn't think so. You'd know better. But the concept of it was okay. So we lost this election. What are we doing? Why are we not bringing in more voters? Because the demographics are changing. And the idea was, the ideas weren't bad. But instead, we went the complete opposite direction and became more exclusive and catering more to white working class voters and turned off the people that you need to grow as a party moving forward to be more reflective of the country. And I think if you had a Kasich or a Rubio or some of those guys that get it, you would have seen, any one of them would have beaten Hillary Clinton. Because you would have seen people hear from Republicans that could give the Republican message in a way that was relatable. Not what Trump has done. He's doubled down on going the other way. And that's a dying demographic. So it's not sustainable.
Yeah, I'll give you the last word on this one. To the point you're just making about those candidates and how the voters would have responded, let's not lose sight of the fact that Trump won 30% of the Hispanic vote, 10% of the black vote, and 52%, 53%, as I was corrected this morning, of the white female educated vote. So I don't know just how much of a difference that necessarily would have played out. I think Trump would have been a factor regardless in the main because
True.
Of where the voters ultimately came down
but,
in this election.
But once someone else had gotten in, the way they would have governed,
I think, what you're saying.
You know what I mean? They would have governed in a way that would have been a lot more inclusive and people would have seen the policies played out in their communities as being more successful and go, oh, okay, and you would have a longer-term investment.
Right.
I agree with Tara. When you think about the Whigs historically, that is the way the Republican Party is going. Edmund Burke, if you guys aren't familiar with Edmund Burke, he's sort of considered the founding father of Western conservatism.
Yeah.
There's a quote in a book that Burke writes about the French Revolution that conservatives reform to conserve. And when you think about the Whigs, you think about the current state of the Republican Party, at times you have to reform as society changes. The Republican Party isn't doing that. What we're doing is becoming reactionary. So as we see progress, we see things, when we're saying, no, not only are we not trusting of these things, we're anti these things, and we want to go back to the way things were when certain people thought they were great for them. And that is extremely concerning to me because I don't see anyone in the party who's sane, such as those individuals who were members of the Whigs who separated and started what we now know as the Republican Party today, saying, this is not sustainable. This is not going to work in a diverse country. We have to start something else. I don't see those voices. I don't hear those voices.
The few exist, but they're not in a position of power.
We've been marginalized so much.
Yes.
As far as our ability to actually bring the type of change that I think people who aren't necessarily Republican voters may say, I could vote for individuals with this R behind their name because they represent X, Y, and Z policies that I think are decent,
right.
That I think are moral, that I think are ethical. There's not enough of us.
Right.
And so while I think we're headed towards the direction of the Whigs, I'm not necessarily sure that there will be a rebirth of conservatism. I'm just not certain of that, and I hate to be cynical, but again, we're talking about a substantial percentage of the country. When you think about the Whigs, again, historically speaking, if you were to quantify this, the percentages that were of that mindset are nowhere near what the percentages of the mindset of folks who support Trump today. So you may be talking about 5% of the country then versus 35% of the country today, and then you talk about a small percentage of African Americans, 35% of Hispanics, a significant percentage of white women. So we're not talking just about those extreme elements that you see wearing the MAGA hats. There are folks that I like to call the quiet Trump supporters. Folks you may live next door to, people you may work with, that you would never know voted for this guy.
Yeah.
So how do you transform the party into something that is all-inclusive of a more diverse country when there's such a significant number of people in the country who are saying, I may not like him as a person, but I agree with a lot of this?
All right, folks, well, on that, we're going to have to end our conversation. So glad to have everybody be a part of the Man of Steel podcast here at K Street Live. We're so glad to be at Politicon. Thank you guys for listening and being a part. I got a real live audience, which is really kind of cool. Bill Crystal, Shermichael Singleton, and of course our wonderful stand-in, Tara Settmeyer. We just pulled out of the audience. Thank you all so much.
Anytime.
Check out the Man of Steel podcast. I'm sure you can catch us on Twitter and on Apple Podcasts, and you catch me on Twitter at Michael Steele. We'll catch you all next time, all right? Be good out there. I want to share a little thought with you. Now, many of you are married, have kids and a mortgage and all that good stuff, right? But you don't have a life insurance policy because you think you can't afford it. Well, let me tell you about John. John is 35 and in pretty good shape. And he got a couple of life insurance quotes, and they were outrageous. Then he called SelectQuote at 1-800-394-8967. The comparison shop highly rated term life insurance companies for him and give you a choice for the best rates. Now, SelectQuote gave John the option of a $1 million policy for under $36 a month or a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month. SelectQuote will get you better rates than by going direct to the insurers. Call them at 1-800-394-8967. That's 1-800-394-8967 or go to selectquote.com. Now, get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states. This podcast is here for you, the Man of Steel. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you stay tuned for another exciting moment with the Man of Steel.